The Heaven Field, a novel by I.G. Hume, read by the author. Episode 5, A Lost Angel. "Ah, Mr. Sullivan," inquired a large man in a military uniform, stepping forward to shake the young man's hand. "Commander James, I'm in charge of this facility. I will take you straight down."
"Thomas, yes, hello, down where?"
he stuttered, fumbling the piles of papers and folders into one hand. He had dressed hurriedly, was unshaven, and his glasses were skewed. He had a mop of unkempt, dark hair, and his skinny limbs poked awkwardly from his ill-fitting clothes. "You are currently the leading authority on standing point particle theories, is that not correct?" asked the commander, ignoring Thomas's question as he ushered the young man down the harshly lit corridor. The commander looked as if he hadn't slept in several days, and his agitated tone belied the effects of caffeine and stress.
"Well, not really the leading authority, no. Not at all, really. I'm just posting my thesis on standing point. I mean, by no means the leading authorities. There's Tomlinson, Keeler, Cook. They're all far..."
"They're all ours," interjected the commander. "Like I said, you're now the leading authority."
"Has something happened?" "I mean, I don't really know what all this is about. Your men here."
Thomas nodded his head towards the two figures marching deadpan behind them. "Sign this, please," said the commander. They had stopped at a security desk. A large metal door adorned with warning and no entry signs was ahead of them. Thomas, in a daze, signed an official-looking document, and the security guard shifted his grip on the submachine gun he carried in order to pass Thomas his clearance badge. He just managed to grab it as Commander James swept him away towards the door, which was now opening for them. He fumbled to clip the badge onto his lapel, whilst half running through the doorway with his host ahead of him. The pile of papers he held went crashing to the floor.
"Leave them," shouted the commander. "Burns, get those," he called to one of his men without looking back.
"But my papers," began Sullivan,
but they were already halfway down the next corridor. The next 10 minutes were a blur for Thomas. Only 2 hours ago he had been fast asleep in his room at the halls of residence, when he had been rudely woken and frog-marched to a waiting car by the tight-lipped Burns and Sanders. He had sat, paralysed, like a frightened rabbit in the back of the police Land Rover, sandwiched between the two sweating soldiers, as an armed policeman drove them madly through the dark streets.
"Bring any notes on your work," had grunted Burns, the one with a nose like a crumpled lump of gristle.
Notes on his work? Sullivan's entire dingy room was crammed with every manner of papers. On shelves, the table, the floor, stuck to walls, in the sink. Fools! But when he had protested, Burns had merely swept the contents of the overflowing desk into his arms and dumped them unceremoniously onto Thomas. Barking into a small microphone on the collar of his flak jacket, Burns had called.
"Removals. Room 10. Colton Block. Various papers. Urgent."
"Do you keep your work on this computer?" inquired Sanders, who seemed the less gruff of the two. It was he who had first spoken to Thomas, when the porter had let the men into his room. Sanders had told him then that he wasn't in immediate danger, but he had to be moved as a matter of national security. All Sullivan's feeble protestations were met with direct commands to hurry him along.
"My what?"
asked Thomas in a daze.
"Do you keep your work on this computer, sir?"
"Well, yes, and at the faculty, but really this is crazy, I..." "Hey!"
Sanders deftly, but none too delicately, unplugged the computer case. He picked it up and strode out of the door past the nervous porter and the few pasty faces of Thomas's fellow hallmates, who had congregated bleary-eyed and curious in the hallway. Sullivan walked the gauntlet of inquiring students, the oppressive Burns guiding him with a huge hand on his shoulder.
"Is everything all right?"
asked Stephen Broadby, his grimy dressing gown pulled roughly about him. But Thomas was already past him and out into the chill of the November night.
"Fascists!"
came a half-hearted protest from behind, as Sullivan saw the police car ahead of him, Sanders already depositing the computer into the boot.
"Like I can even spell it,"
chuckled Burns to himself, as he hefted his bulk into the rear seat, his shoulder squashing into Thomas's ear. Now Thomas tried to replay those events, plus the journey to the military base, as Commander James hurried him down corridor after corridor. The room Sullivan glimpsed as they flew past open doors,
held throngs of agitated military staff. Telephones seemed to be ringing everywhere, as more and more people ran past or bustled about them. The personnel took care to avoid a collision with the commander, and saluted him on the occasion they recognised him in time. For his part, the commander seemed oblivious to them all, merely wading through them, Sullivan in tow. Although the frenetic staff parted like a tide for the commander, the throng instantly closed again upon his passing, and Thomas found himself buffeted, elbowed, and shoved from all quarters. On several occasions he would have fallen, had it not been for Sanders, ever at his back, who caught him whenever he stumbled. After an age, they approached the largest, most imposing of the security stations. A guard checked their passes and saluted the commander as he radioed through for the gate to be opened. Once through this, the plain white corridors were much quieter, and the commander led them into a small lift. "I must give you my deepest apologies," began the commander, as Thomas felt the lift begin to descend. "We are in a terrible state of emergency, and I'm afraid we simply didn't have time for pleasantries earlier. Now I know you will be wondering just what on earth all this is about, but I'm sure we will be able to fill you in as we go along."
"Am I under arrest?"
whispered Thomas, wide-eyed and still sick to the stomach.
"Arrest? Why, of course not. You came to us for a job, did you not?" exclaimed the commander.
"This is Hyden Hill,"
stuttered Thomas, referring to the job offer he had recently received after his interview at the research centre.
"Hyden Hill? No, no, this is Maunsworth. Sanders, just what have you told him?"
inquired James of the big man at Thomas's shoulder.
"I was just told to bring him in, sir," said Sanders methodically, then grinned a little. "He's not much of a conversationalist either, sir."
"That's enough, Sanders," reprimanded the commander, stifling a slight smile.
"No wonder you're so upset," he said, placing a reassuring hand on Thomas's shoulder. Thomas felt even smaller between these two giants.
"This is Maunsworth Military Facility. It houses a research centre twinned with Hyden Hill. There was an accident last night, here at our facility."
He spoke slowly, choosing his words with care.
"We need everyone we can get who knows about Standing Point, and we need them fast. We pulled the records of your interview and hoped you would start work for us early. You come highly recommended. Hell of a first day at work, is it not?"
He gave a sympathetic smile of encouragement.
"We need your help and your expertise."
"But I'm just a theoretician. I have no..."
mumbled Sullivan.
"We need your expertise," repeated the commander, "for a rescue mission."
The headlights of the taxi illuminated the ominous, derelict buildings rising up and closing in around them.
"Are you sure this is where you want to be, mate? Do you want me to wait for you?" asked the taxi driver, as he pulled to a stop outside the dark front of an abandoned warehouse. Every window was smashed, and grass grew high up against the sides of its crumbling walls.
A rusty metal fence to their left, topped with barbed wire, glistened with frost in the headlights. Dragor looked nervously at the ruined building. He held his small case across his knees as if for protection.
"This will be fine," he croaked. "You do not need to wait for me. Thank you."
"Suit yourself," said the driver suspiciously, as he accepted the money for the fare. "Good night."
"Good night,"
whispered Dragor, as he watched the taxi drive off into the darkness, leaving him alone in the foreboding industrial estate. He turned to survey the warehouse and shrieked. A dark figure was standing motionless, barely 2 feet away from him.
"Perhaps you'd like to shout it a little louder," drawled Alex.
"Alexei," breathed Dragor in relief.
The two men embraced and kissed each other on the cheeks.
"The taxi was damn sloppy, my friend," said Alex, turning towards the door of the warehouse.
"I'm sorry, Alexei. I panicked. Is it safe?"
he asked, looking up at the crumbling facade. He could just make out the faded letters on the brickwork, reading Watkins Textiles.
"Safe enough," murmured Alex, and walked through the open doorway.
He let Dragor past and then carefully placed a row of empty bottles across the doorstep in the shadows. He looked up at Dragor and shrugged.
Just in case, he grinned.
You always were methodical, Alexei, said Dragor, relaxing a little.
Alex quietly shut the door behind them and led Dragor up a narrow flight of metal steps. The second floor opened out into a huge hall, strewn with broken glass and litter. The two longest walls were lined with empty windows. An orange street lamp outside gave a faint illumination, casting dark, crazy shadows. Alex walked over to the far corner of the room, where an old sofa sat next to a couple of beer crates, with a rotten door resting on them as a table.
A real home from home, he smiled, sitting on the wide windowsill by the table.
I never came here during the Beringer incident. This was the safe house, wasn't it?
Murmured Dragor, gazing around at the filth as he sat down gingerly on the edge of the sofa.
I didn't realize it was quite so run down.
It was okay, shrugged Alex. We spent about 3 months operating out of here. I guess I got to quite like the place.
He took a long look out of the window, then turned solemnly towards Dragor.
Tell me everything, he sighed at last.
A rescue mission, echoed Sullivan, but the lift doors were already opening, and Commander James was on the move again. They were walking across a bustling concourse with a high ceiling, curving walls and low mezzanine surrounding it. A large circular fountain dominated the centre of the hall. The concourse looked incongruous against the high security, military coldness Thomas had been bombarded with up until now. It felt like a busy waiting room in some cosmopolitan railway station. James seemed to spot who he was looking for, and trotted after a middle-aged woman wearing jeans and a polo-neck jumper, under a white lab coat. She was making her way towards one of the many corridors which led off the hall.
Grace, one moment, please, called the commander as he caught up with her.
The woman turned and gave a sigh when she recognized him, glancing at her watch as if she guessed this encounter would take up too much of her precious time. Thomas followed obediently and stopped by the commander's side. The woman flashed him a terse glance and looked back to James before Thomas could nervously smile a greeting. She was in her mid-50s, Thomas thought, with piercing grey eyes and a kind face, heavily lined yet attractive, as if wisdom were carved into it. Her greying hair fell in loose curls to just above her shoulders. She held a clipboard in one hand and a polystyrene cup of coffee in the other. A biro was tucked behind her ear.
Grace, good to see you. I hope everything is going well, said James, although with a slight reservation in his voice.
Is this going to take long, Colin? Interjected Grace. I have got one or two things to be doing.
Her voice was tired yet animated, and loaded with sarcasm.
I'd like to introduce you to Thomas Sullivan. I believe he is a leading light in your field.
The commander gestured to Thomas, who smiled nervously and offered his hand to her. She ignored it.
Never heard of him. My God, Colin, are you just dragging anybody off the streets that can pronounce Standing Point? I don't need another...
Thomas, I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Grace Palmer, acting head of our facility here. She'll brief you on immediate events and we'll get somebody to show you around.
Oh, Jesus, Colin. Don't you think I've got enough on my plate without being nanny to some college?
You need all the help you can get, broke in James, in a calm but firm tone. I have been reliably informed that Mr. Sullivan will be of service to you.
Oh, I don't have time for this.
It is the others who are running out of time, breathed the commander quietly. He will be of help, I'm sure.
Grace looked downcast at this and stayed silent.
Who's in trouble? Asked Thomas, attempting to break the tension.
My colleagues, there was an accident. It's all going the same way as Hyden Hill, said Grace.
There was an accident there?
Asked Thomas. He'd been there for an interview a couple of months ago. Grace looked downcast.
A big one. I was away.
She gave a sigh, then started hunting about in her pockets.
Have you got a cigarette?
She suddenly piped up to Thomas, when her searching proved fruitless. Her sombre mood seemed instantly dispersed.
I don't smoke. Sorry, he stuttered.
Dr. Palmer was on suspension for a criminal offence when an accident occurred at our sister facility, Hyden Hill,
spoke James evenly, still staring intently at Palmer.
"Oh, for pity's sake, Colin," she chastised,
her eyes glancing up at the commander and then darting back to the floor. She shifted uneasily.
"God, it was just a bit of dope. Everyone gets so anal here, it's like living in a convent."
"This is a military facility, Dr. Palmer, and I will not tolerate offences committed on this soil whilst I am in charge. Is that clear?" James's voice didn't rise in volume, but he was obviously furious.
"You know, I'm a civilian," protested Grace, herself becoming indignant. "If I was caught smoking a little pot anywhere else, I..." "This is not anywhere else!" exploded the commander.
The entire concourse of people stopped their conversations and turned to stare. Thomas cringed and studied the floor.
"This is neither the time or the place now, Grace. You are under review. We have important things to be dealing with."
James had regained his composure again.
"Debrief Sullivan. We can't do anything until the chamber is up and running anyway, and that is in the hands of engineering."
Palmer opened her mouth to protest again, then, as if seeing the weariness in James's eyes, sighed to herself and looked at Sullivan.
"Come on then, Timothy. Welcome to the madhouse."
She glanced up at Commander James for a second, and then turned on her heel and headed off down the corridor. Thomas looked inquiringly at the commander, but he was already striding off back towards the lift. Sanders still stood impassively at Sullivan's side. Thomas turned back to see Dr. Palmer halfway down the corridor, walking fast while studying her clipboard.
It's Thomas. My name's Thomas," he called, and scuttled nervously after her, Sanders at his shoulder.
"Hey, Saul. Wake up. Wake up, Saul. Wake up."
Saul Davison slowly drifted round, then jumped up with a start. He was staring into Nix's face.
"Hey, what's wrong? What's the matter?"
he muttered, coming around slowly. Nix stopped shaking Saul's arm and grinned.
"Hate to disturb your beauty sleep, but it's your shift," he said.
He handed Davison a battered and corroded wrist pack.
"Here, there's only Dan's clock that still works."
"Have I really slept for 3 hours?"
asked Davison.
"Snoring like a baby," grinned Nix. "I thought the noise was going to break my earpiece."
"Still no sign?"
asked Davison quietly. He could hear the heavy breathing of Starling and O'Keefe in his ear. They were asleep in the far corner of the cave.
"No sign. Look, Saul, we're running out of time. I know that the suits don't seem to be failing as quickly, now that we're out of the storm, but we're halfway through our tanks already."
I know, repeated Davison anxiously.
"But what can we do? There's no point going back to camp until we get some word from home."
"That's assuming we can find it again," said Nix quietly, nervously looking over to where Starling and O'Keefe slept.
"Do you think Gary's tracker will last out?" sighed Davison.
Nix shrugged.
"If it doesn't, I don't think we'll ever find the doorway in this storm." "Then we'll have to hope the rescue team finds us first," he whispered.
He sat alone, watching the sandstorm rage outside the cave. The weak sun piercing the clouds hadn't moved its position in the entire time they had been in the field. He gazed at his three sleeping companions, wondering if they would ever hear from home again. Dragor sighed. He still held his small case nervously across his lap.
"I have told you, Alexei. You probably know more than I. I am only the liaison. They have no reason to tell me more," he stuttered.
"But you hear things, Dragor. You were back at the fortress more recently than me. Surely you must have heard something," said Alex in exasperation.
"All I know is that Henschel made contact with a group of foreigners who had someone inside the Monsworth facility," he said.
"But who, Dragor?"
I don't know. Americans, I think. They had someone in the labs doing a little scientific espionage. It was all grubby business spying, you know, the sort of thing. We went along with that, claiming we could sabotage the Standing Point project.
Is that what the money was for? The fee I had to collect, said Alex.
Yes, though the money was neither here nor there, sighed Dragor. But they got one of our team into the facility, so that you could gain access to the girls.
Alex looked away at the mention of Patty, and especially Sally Ames. He needed to put that to the back of his mind right now.
And do you know who their plant is in the facility? The one that got Dan Erlin, he said at last. No, nobody told me that. But I did get the impression that it was a woman.
Why do you say that?
Oh, I just think I heard somebody say she when talking about her. I could be wrong, he sighed.
Don't be wrong. We may need to find her, said Alex grimly.
What do you mean, Alexei? Surely we should be thinking of how to get out of the country, back to the fortress. We can't stay here, they'll be after us.
Dragor was getting the hysterical tone back in his voice. Alex looked solemnly out of the window once more.
Whoever is working against us set us up to destroy the English research, and now they are determined to destroy us. They appear to have excellent knowledge of our team over here. If they know that much, his voice trailed off.
You think they may know of the fortress?
Asked Dragor with a look of dread. We may have nowhere to escape to, my friend, sighed Alex. How long is it since you last contacted them?
Almost 1 week now, stuttered Milovich, looking pale. I was supposed to contact Prague, to report on today's events.
And you haven't?
I didn't dare, Alexei, stammered Dragor. The codebook and transmitter are in a room of the Mount Hotel in town. I didn't dare go, he said, lowering his head shamefully.
Well, that must be our first job, said Alex. We need to warn them, or at least find out their current situation.
Alex couldn't face the consequences if they had been discovered. 20 years of work may have been wiped away.
I have a key, muttered Dragor, rummaging in his briefcase.
He pulled out a keyring and removed a single small key from it.
Here, take it, Alexei, he said, holding it out towards Alex. Room 13, in the name of home. Take it.
You look after it, Dragor. We'll go down tomorrow morning and establish contact. Now get some rest. You look exhausted.
Take it, please, Alexei, pleaded Milovich. I would feel much more confident if you held it.
Something in Dragor's voice made Alex lean forward and take the key. He placed it in a compartment of his wallet.
Now get some sleep, Dragor, he said quietly.
Dragor lay down on the damp sofa and closed his eyes. Alex continued to stare out of the window, seemingly unconcerned by the chill wind blowing in through the empty frames.
Alexei, my friend, whispered Dragor quietly, his eyes still closed. Do you have a gun?
Alex looked down at the small man curled up on the chair.
We don't need a gun, Dragor, said Alex solemnly. This isn't the movies.
He stared back out of the window, wishing secretly to himself that he did indeed possess a weapon of some sort.
You have been listening to The Heaven Field. For more information, downloads, and artwork, visit theheavenfield.com.